Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 17, delivered on March 29, 2012. The title of this lecture is Antitrust Law.
Today, antitrust law. In the last lecture, I introduced the historical context in which antitrust law began to develop in the United States. The latter half of the 19th century, especially after the Civil War, was a time of extraordinary development, economic development in the country, especially in the North. Industrial output was increasing, cities were becoming dominated by factories. Early in the morning, you would see many, many workers just trudging to work, coming in on the rail lines, going to jobs, then dragging themselves home at the end of the day. I will get into that more when we get to labor issues, the worker side of it. But the business side of it was vibrant. At the street level, you had just teeming numbers of merchants in the cities, everything from bakers and butchers to restaurants to clothiers. It was quite an active scene, especially as the latter half of the 19th century proceeded. But in the same time frame, when you saw this entrepreneurial blossoming in the country at the street level, at the level of the small merchant, you also saw the rise of these dominant, powerful interests in the manufacturing sector, especially. Just enormous companies that seem to be competing with one another for the business of, for business. But in fact, they were colluding. They were gathering market power, market concentration, and they were using their wealth for all manner of perhaps less than desirable things. Their wealth would allow them to acquire more economic power. Their wealth would allow them to acquire political power. As I had told you before, in that era, our government was the best government that money could buy. Probably about like what it is today. Although there are countervailing forces today that really were not there in that time. Everything from senators and representatives at the state level to the federal level, the judges, the commissioners, the aldermen, the police, the judges, they were tainted by this wealth that ensured their interests were advanced and protected. That is not a good sign when you're coming to, when you're talking about reform. And reform was needed because, as you've seen in previous lectures, concentrated markets have higher prices. They have limited output and charge higher prices. They absorb consumer surplus. They dispense with producer surplus. Output is lowered. Employment is lower. And so that is not what we would consider to be the ideal for a capitalist free market system. Certainly it's free market to the extent that these companies were free to do what they wanted, but it wasn't in the interests of the people who paid the higher prices, and the government, which paid higher prices for its products too. this collusion among powerful players, the bosses of the cities and of the industries, came to a refinement in the 1880s in a legal contract called a trust. This, if I recall correctly, was actually the legal framework was designed by an attorney for Standard Oil. Now, a trust works, and I'm being quite simplistic about this. I would be more specific in a higher level course. But a trust essentially works like this. You have companies that seem to compete against each other. Companies A, B, and C, and D in some industry producing some product or group of products. Now the trust, and now these are shareholder companies. These companies have stock or some kind of ownership representation like common stock. But what happens is that they agree to create a separate corporation. And then these companies that seem to be competitors, their owners, their controllers, vest their ownership or a large part of it into this corporation. So these companies essentially become owned by the trust. And the trust is owned by the power brokers, the owners of the companies that seem to be competitors. And in this way, the trust becomes the monopoly hiding behind what are for all intents and purposes, front companies. And so then they can make all of the arrangements that a monopoly can to reduce output to cause higher prices. You're the owner of company A. We're going to see to it you've got the Chicago market, you've got the New York market, you've got Boston, you've got the San Francisco LA axis. That way we make sure that we're not competing against each other, and in each of the markets there is a spatial monopoly. Or okay, we're going to have you produce, you could be producing 100,000 units a day, you're going to produce 30,000, you could produce 80,000 a day, we're going to have you producing 20,000, thereby each of you reducing your output and causing the price to go up sufficiently high that it's worth it for you to reduce your output like that. And then we just keep an eye on you. And then if we have some company, like, for example, someone like you has a company that comes into the business and decides that you're going to compete, try to go head-to-head with us, we invite you to join our trust. Please, come with us. You know, we'll make you wealthy. If you choose not to do that, we'll make sure that you are extraordinarily sorry that you didn't do that. Violence was not unheard of in ensuring that competition didn't get in the way of a good profit. And as these trusts proliferated, they were quite successful and they were not illegal. You saw considerable growth in the economic power of the owners of these corporations. From the city level clear to the federal level, they had the money to make sure that nothing got in their way as far as laws went. Strangest thing about it, though, is that, surprise, surprise, no one was fooled. Everyone from the common worker up through to the highest levels of office at the federal level, everyone knew this game was going on. Everyone knew it was detrimental to a larger vision of economic activity in this country that saw competition as being good and monopoly as being bad. We knew it. And notwithstanding the apologists, and there were apologists all over the place, politicians would get up there and swear to God that everything was okay. Economists would get up there and they would take their dirty paychecks on the side and then spout that it was okay. You had lawyers. You had all kinds of people swearing that it was okay or that there wasn't anything wrong or praising free markets or whatever. But no one was fooled. We were in an era of concentrated industries that were causing prices to be higher, output to be lower. They were damaging employment. They were also causing disruptions in capital markets and in physical resources markets as they distorted the flows of capital, as they distorted the flows of resources. So how do you deal with it? How can you have reform in an era when everyone knows the game, but the people who could change the game are on the take? And yes, they were on the take. Let's try something. I want you to name me two presidents from the last half, after Abraham Lincoln. Name me two presidents from the last half of the 19th century. Can you do that?
Any of them?
Name two of them. Give me two.
Bush and Obama.
From the 19th century? Let's try after Lincoln. 1865, when that son of a bitch was shot, on up to 1900.
I don't know.
You can't name him, can you? That's okay. Part of that, your history education sucks. But really, they were the most unmemorable bastard you would ever want to think about. Grant was one of them. Unmemorable man. Andrew Johnson, probably part of the conspiracy to kill Lincoln. Who?
McClellan, no.
Work it, girl. Never mind. The point I'm making is that these guys were unmemorable. They were a bunch of stiff-shirt, suited shills of corporate America. They really were. One of them was, in fact, a gay man. Did you know that? We had a gay president in the last... everyone knew it. I mean, there were even jokes in Washington. His inner circle was known as the Washington Nancys. But that's part of history that you don't know either. You don't know all of this stuff about history, and I'm going to share with you some context of history. And here's where I get a chance to show you, talk to you about something fascinating about history that is misrepresented so much in history textbooks, in popular movies, and even in books, many books. In an era when you have corruption, bad things happening, and just a dire time, we imagine that the only way that this can be fixed is by some great reformer coming in on a shining white horse, slaying the bad guys, and restoring the universe to its rightful position. Gandalf the White finally rides to the rescue, or something like that. It's not how history works, though, really. It actually doesn't usually work that way. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to take you forward into the 20th century, the last half of the 20th century. And this is before your time. You might have heard some about it, but I'll bet you haven't heard a lot about it. Or what you've heard has been sort of like a combination of fact, fiction, folklore, whatever. In the 1950s. We had come out of the Great Depression and we had gone through World War II. The great heroes of the war, as far as the leaders go, there was, of course, Roosevelt on this side of the Atlantic, and there was Churchill on the other side of the Atlantic. But once their heroism had been exhausted and the country wanted to move on, in our country, we brought back into office the Republicans, who had been repudiated so thoroughly at the beginning of the 1930s that there were some people who said that party will never rise again. Well, it did. There were Republican gains in Congress, even in World War II, as people got tired of the economic problems that the war was causing at home. And certainly after the war, Roosevelt's successor in office, Truman, was not a dynamic man at all. And ultimately, in the 1950s, a Republican president was brought into office. I consider him to be the last great Republican president, just an absolute shining tower. There are some dark, dark stories about him, but there are also some amazing stories of how great he was. Great because he was a moderate. He had given a tax cut that the Republican Congress had been squawking for early in his administration. But after that, he said no to more tax cuts. He also said no to the demands of the Democrats for an opening of social programs that they wanted. He said no to both sides, and he didn't expand a lot of government programs. He didn't cut taxes. Even his own party, his own vice president, Richard Nixon, criticized him heavily behind closed doors because he wouldn't do these tax cuts. The Republicans are forever crying tax cuts, tax cuts, less regulation for business, more regulation on labor unions, blah, blah, blah. It's the same story as always. And Eisenhower wasn't that kind of a president. He was just old school. Very dignified. And the economic growth of the country was quite stable, but not spectacular. Around maybe a 2.5% growth rate. Well, that was just not acceptable. We should be able to grow faster than that, some called. And the way to do that is to cut taxes. No, the way to do that is to expand government intervention in the economy. It went back and forth, on and on. And Eisenhower just, meh. Stop it. In his last speech to Congress, he even jumped into down the throats of his own Republican rabble-rousers in the House of Representatives. I gave you your damn tax cuts. Quit it. Lay off. And also, here's another thing. This military-industrial complex that's growing, you love yourself some war machinery, we're going to be sorry for that someday. Beware the military-industrial complex. He was that kind of a man. A war hero if in some ways. Certainly a leader. A military man. A general. Saying things like that. He knew where it was going. Old school. Moderate. He was the last president before Bill Clinton to balance the federal budget deficit. No, we're not going to cut taxes. No, we're not going to spend huge amounts of money. We're going to do things right. God, is that boring. The election of 1960 was, Eisenhower had completed the two terms he could, and so it came down to a choice between the Republican, his vice president, Richard Milhouse Nixon, and this brash, younger, Eastern liberal Catholic named John Fitzgerald Kennedy on the Democrat side. It was a clash of two very different kinds of men. Nixon, short, hunched a little bit, just kind of not very public oriented, but you didn't have to be in the old days because there wasn't any television or anything like that. And then there was John Kennedy, this brash, tall, good-looking as all get-out man. He knew all of the great famous people. He was into the Hollywood crowd. He spoke with this Eastern accent, and he said things that just made people know he was so modern. The suit from New York, the haircut that was just the style of the day. He was the new, and Richard Nixon was the old. No better place did this come about than did this become so obvious was in the first live television debate between two presidential candidates. Now, before the era of color television, high definition, and all of that, live television was something different. You had extraordinarily powerful lights that had to be used because the cameras didn't have sensitive equipment, light sensors, and all that kind of stuff. You had very strong, powerful lighting, black and white. You had more close in, they had to be to get definition on the people on camera. And so you had this live debate. And there on the one side was Richard Nixon, a man who didn't stand up very tall anyway, and he kind of hunched over, had his head down during the debate, looking up. So the lights cast him like some kind of small gargoyle. A tiny bit of 5 o'clock shadow. Who shaves before in the afternoon? Became like he sort of looked like a yeti in a suit. And then there, right beside him, was Jack Kennedy, just absorbing the light, standing tall, good-looking suit, makeup from his own people who had knew how cameras and makeup worked together. It was a rout. You had Richard Nixon and Jack Kennedy, hi everybody. It was a slaughter. John Kennedy was elected president, and it did introduce to official public perception a new era. Now, certainly this new era had been coming. The 1950s was the era when loud music that was the successor of the swing and all of that of the 40s came to be the rock and roll, the rockabilly, all that kind of music. Changes were happening. People were beginning to talk about civil rights in a very broad way. We can't just keep discriminating against black people the way we have. We can't do it anymore. These hangings in the South that happen all the time, this constant discrimination, this constant treating of people wrongly, we're better than that. And the idealists of the time were writing a lot about it. You also had in literature the beatnik movement coming along, beatnik literature, just crazy for its time. Art was getting really radical. Music, you name it. Jack Kennedy was the kind of man who sort of presented the dignified spear point of a new world. The name for his White House was Camelot. It was like a new place. Jackie Kennedy, his wife, was so modern. The modern hairdo, the clothes that were from the best houses in New York and Paris. She redecorated the White House and then took everyone in the country on a tour of the White House on television. Who had ever heard of anything like that? Such a couple they were. And, of course, Jack Kennedy, just adding to his mystique, were the rumors that he was, you know, sleeping with other women once in a while and that he was all kinds of this and that. You should have heard in my time, I remember, he was a Catholic, so God, the right-wing nutcases, the Pope's going to take over this country. He's a Catholic, you know. Sounds sort of like, he's a Muslim, you know. Oh, it was the same thing back then. Oh, God, the world's going to come to an end, and before you know it, there are going to be Negroes in our bathrooms if we don't stop this kind of nonsense. He was fearless in some ways, but he was actually not the kind of man that Roosevelt had been. He was more almost like a transitional figure between Franklin Roosevelt and Barack Obama. He was more willing to negotiate with Republicans. You want a tax cut? Okay, I think that might be a good idea. That military-industrial complex bullshit that Eisenhower was so worried about, let's bring it on. Let's let companies get together and aggregate. It's funny that way. He was sort of like a transitional figure, like I said. But in many ways, he was so idealistic. We are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this decade. And of course, you know, anyone who was academic engineering, that's very funny. You're serious? What? And it happened. We actually cut a piece out of the middle of the 21st century and set it into the middle of the 20th century. We haven't been back to the moon since then, but why did we do that? Because Jack wanted it done, and so we hustled, and we got it done in July of 1969. We put a man on the moon. Why? Because Jack wanted it. Oh, Jack Kennedy had some other ideas, too. A comprehensive civil rights act that would prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, creed, national origin, sex, you name it. They didn't include sexual orientation, unfortunately, but it was awfully, awfully broad. Oh, God. I remember how horrible it was. Oh, this is the apocalypse in small town Midwest America and in the South. Oh, God. That Catholic son of a bitch is going to give equal rights to Negroes. Do you know what that's going to lead to? They're going to start sleeping with our white daughters. I heard it in a church. I was told that. That was how horrible it was. They're going to be rioting in the streets. Have you ever smelled one of those people? My God, Lincoln really made a mistake back then. Now here we go. Here comes Jack Kennedy along. Someone's got to do something about that man. Someone's got to do something. Well, Camelot kept rolling. We started getting interested in pushing adventure in other countries. Kennedy had no use for communists, and if the communists were starting to stomp around in Southeast Asia, well, we were going to go in there and send some advisors to make sure that we kept things under control. We want industries to grow fast. Well, we got some economists who say if we have powerful labor unions, we can allow those to be a countervailing force against powerful concentrated industries. So you had industrial policy beginning to rise. You had all kinds of different concepts, new ways of doing things, and you had this proposal to equalize the society, to make it public policy that we would not discriminate in this country. We would end it at the official public policy level. Now, there had been civil rights acts before this. Don't get me wrong. They were very limited special interest civil rights acts. This was broad and comprehensive. Believe me, John Kennedy, his bro, Bobby, was a bitch. And he was the Attorney General. And Bobby Kennedy, if he didn't want something in this country, it was not going to be in this country. And that went from the mafia on through to a lot of other nefarious activities that were going on at the time. Bobby Kennedy was an enforcer with an iron fist. So if there was going to be a civil rights act, there was going to be a daddy to kick the ass of all the southern redneck white boys who didn't want that civil rights act. And so Camelot rolled. Until a day in November in 1963 in Dallas. And Camelot came to an end with a perfect headshot. Of course, we know it was a lone gunman, obviously. But the era of Camelot ended in an open motorcade when Kennedy was assassinated. His brains were splattered on several people. He fell into Jackie's lap, and they took him off to a gurney, and that was the end of it. His vice president was a southern white blue dog Democrat by the name of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Now, if ever there were a man who had a white sheet hanging in his closet just in case there was a parade, it would have been Lyndon Johnson. Johnson was old school blue dog, racist to the bottom of his bone, good old boy, Southern Democrat, slap the backs, make the deals, all that kind of stuff. Story goes that Johnson was so terrified of what was about to fall on his shoulders that he was in Air Force Two, cowering in the bathroom, sobbing. He was talked out of the bathroom. They got him together, cleaned him up, and there's this famous picture of him being sworn into office with his hand on a Bible. It looks damn good for a man who about 10 minutes before had been shitting himself pretty much. But he put himself together and he took over. Jack was being photographed dead on a gurney in a hospital, and Lyndon Johnson was becoming the president of the United States, much to his consternation. But thank God, it was Lyndon Johnson, because Lyndon Johnson was sane. He was a good man, and he knew that this bullshit with the Civil Rights Act wasn't going to get anywhere. A good old boy, Blue Dog Democrat. Yeah, Civil Rights Act hasn't got a chance in hell. Funniest thing about it, wasn't too long before Lyndon Johnson started calling his old boy network in Congress. He had been a senator. He started calling senators and representatives, those Southern Blue Dog Democrats who had blocked the Civil Rights Act in the legislature, he started calling. He said, I want you to come into my office. We're going to talk for a while. He brought them in, one at a time, closed the door. You're going to vote for the Civil Rights Act. Well, Lyndon, what the hell you mean? You don't want this. I know. But you're going to vote for it. Well, why? What the hell? Because what Jack wanted. No! Yes, you are. And if you don't, I'm going to tell who you slept with last year. It wasn't your wife, was it? I'm going to tell everyone who you're taking your money from. He did it. He was hardball. He was really old school. I don't care. It's what Jack wanted. And if you aren't going to do it, I'm going to show everyone what you are. Well, I'll show what you are. That's okay, because I'm the president. As he was famous to have said once during a campaign, to show you how vicious Lyndon Johnson was, I want you to go out there and tell everyone that my opponent is a pig fucker. Well, he isn't a pig fucker. Well, I know that. But once I say it, he's going to have to deny it. And I want to hear him deny that he's a pig fucker. That's actually a famous thing. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, making it federal policy. Public policy in law, the law of the land, that this country would not tolerate discrimination on the basis of race, sex, creed, national origin. What you have, if you are anything other than an Anglo-Saxon white, rests upon the people who stood tall and went to bat for you. And the point of this story, and I take a long time, make sure you understand this story, is that this was not some radical reformer riding in from the hinterlands on a white horse. This was an insider who did this. One of the good old boys. One of the people who had been the enforcers of racism. Who was the one who changed the world. And he literally did. You don't know what it was like in my time. I mean, you just used bad words on black people. It was just, okay, yeah, it's normal for them to have their own water fountains away from ours. Yeah, that's typical. A girl getting a job over a guy? Bullshit. A girl thinking that she doesn't need to bend over at the job to keep her job? All of that went away slowly. It's still there hiding in the wings, though. Don't make any mistake about that. Monsters don't die. They just run and hide until everyone forgets how bad it was when they were in control. But make no mistake about it. Reform came not on the spear point of the radical, but on the club of the insider. I'll take you back now to 1800s. In the very hotbed of the time when corruption was riveting Washington to the wall of corporate America, the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 was passed. The first national law, there had been some state laws, but the first national law that expressed in public policy, that expressed the public policy that concentrated industries are undesirable. This was a trust-busting law, and it was the first of its kind. Know this about law, and I would explain this in a little more detail if you took a business law course from me. But oftentimes, when laws, a new area of law is first brought forward, it can actually be somewhat difficult to understand how to craft the law. You don't know how, first of all, you don't know what really might be needed. You can't foresee circumstances, consequences. You don't know how the courts are going to rule on constitutionality or how they're going to interpret the law. You're really feeling in the dark when you probe into brand new territory. Undesirable consequences or unexpected things can happen. But the antitrust law of 1890 was at least a try. I'm putting up a PowerPoint presentation on my website, hcc-prof.com. It'll be up there tonight, scrolling marquee. You don't have to write down what I'm saying here. It's all the text is here. But I want to read you just the first two sections, briefly, from the first two sections of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. And it's more important, instead of writing it down, you'll see it in the PowerPoint. It's not a very long PowerPoint. But I want you to listen carefully, and then I will refer back to this in a few moments. But in Section 1 prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies that constitute or create an environment for the restraint of trade. Now, I want to say that again. Section 1. Now, I want you to remember, I just said Section 1. I'll come back to that in a moment or two. Section 1 prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies that constitute or create an environment for the restraint of trade. Section 2 prohibits monopolizations and conspiracies to monopolize. Now, I'll say this right now, that there had been no legislation like this before. So we're using words like contracts, combinations, or conspiracies that constitute or create an environment for the restraint of trade. The wording is actually, it sounds very specific, it's actually quite vague. Well, a contract that constitutes or creates an environment? What do you mean an environment? For the restraint of trade, what constitutes restraint of trade? What do you mean restraint of trade? Are they actually holding people back from buying the good? Or what the hell is that? This word conspiracy, it keeps showing up. What's a conspiracy? Oh, if I'm a donut maker and you're a donut maker down the street and we walk past each other on the street, oh, how's business? Oh, it's doing okay, how's your business? Oh, it's not bad. Or are we in a conspiracy together? You can already smell the lawyers for the corporations, the trusts, gathering like buzzards over the carcass of this. But it was enforced to the extent possible. And it was successful in several major cases. It was successful. The most famous of them was Standard Oil of New Jersey. There was also American Tobacco, and there was a sugar, and there was also a... But Standard Oil of New Jersey is like a touchstone. The trust was run, was owned by, or dominated by, a fellow named John D. Rockefeller. Now, even when I was growing up, John D. was hated. Here was John D.'s trick. John D. Rockefeller had the oil company, and he developed a chain of gas stations when gasoline-powered automobiles started coming on the roads. And a lot, it wasn't just the automobiles. There were all kinds of things were going on at the time that were these internal combustion engines that used fossil fuels were getting to be a really big thing. Tractors, stuff like that. But, yeah, I mean, he would go in, see, and gasoline stations were showing up all over the country. Small town America, you started seeing gas stations. And even in my time, they were actually a lot cooler than they are now. You had the gas, you had these gas pumps that had these giant glass jars on top of them, or globes. And you actually use a hand crank to pump gas into the globe, and they'd have little colorful balls that would spin around, and then you would pump the gas out of the globe into your car. Really cool stuff. And this kind of stuff was coming up all over the country, small town America. Well, what John D. Rockefeller would do is he'd take one of his gas stations and he would put it into a small town where there were other gas stations. And he would charge way lower price for gasoline than the other gas stations would. Why? Because he owned an oil company. He could do it. And of course, everyone's just, oh my God, John D's come to town. Look at this Standard Oil station. Fill up on his gas. The other gas stations, of course, collapsed, died. He bought up the properties, and then guess what he did to the price of gas in town? Well, spank me Jesus. Monopoly. Lower output, higher price. It got to be such a thing. And of course, even after people knew what he was doing, they'd still go to his gas stations when they came to town because you're stupid. Yeah, I'll buy that product. Yeah, what's wrong with Microsoft? What's wrong with Apple? What's wrong with Verizon? I'll buy them, yeah. Better gasoline. Cheaper, too. Not that that's what motivates me. Of course it is. And you're acting in your own self-interest, aren't you, idiots? But it went on over and over. And people came to hate John D. His name was associated with hate at its core. When I was growing up, and as a little kid, in the hills of Kentucky, we still had manual transmission cars. You know, you shifted in gear. We would be at the top of a hill. And when I say hill in the Appalachians, hill is in quotation marks. You would hear my father, he would inevitably say, well, we're going to cheat old John D. now. And he would put the car into neutral. And we would go down the hill without power. That was cheating old John D., and I even say it to this day, I'm going to cheat old John D. Well, back in that time, down in the hills, you had to be pretty skilled to do that. I remember more than one occasion, especially one night when we had relatives from the flatlands in. Dad got up there at the top of the hill. We're going to cheat old John D. And they looked at him, well, what the hell are you talking about? He kicked out of gear, and we went down the hill, spinning around. We nearly missed this one hairpin. And all he said was, shit. And everyone in the back pretty much did, because they didn't. I was comfortable. Yeah, Uncle, why are you acting like that? You know, never mind. That car went over the. See that thing down there? It went over there last year. That was just, he wasn't watching. There were cars down at the bottom. Cheating old John D. was actually an art form, and of course you didn't want to apply the brakes too much because if you held the brakes down too long, the brake fluid would actually boil, and then you wouldn't have the brakes if you really needed them. But anyway, John D. was hated, and the trust was busted by the Sherman Antitrust Act. But there was a problem in what happened at the Supreme Court. Understand that the Supreme Court is always comprises judges from justices, associate justices, and a chief justice from a long period of time, from different presidents. So even if you had a reform-minded law, you were going to put that in constitutional test against judges at the Supreme Court, and even at the appellate level, who were old school, old boy, and in that era, very much pro-business, very much, by our standards, ultra-conservative. Now, the petitions went to the Supreme Court, and the case came down to two different views. Now, the way the Supreme Court works is that they will take arguments from both sides, but they will also take what are called amicus or friend of court briefings from interested outside parties. And there were two schools of economics at the time that were approaching the Supreme Court on a ruling in Standard Oil. One school said, justices, you should look at this law by a performance standard. And the other way of looking at it is simply by a pro se standard, or a, and I'll put it as pro se. Now let me explain. You in your lives are actually, we as citizens face pro se law. Criminal law is pro se. If you did it, that's all that matters. You done it, that's it. Business law has often been crafted in performance. It's not enough for the prosecutors to show you did it. You also have to, the prosecutors also have to show that you caused harm measurably in so doing. So when you break the speed limit, all that matters is you broke the speed limit. Now that's a pro se approach. Pro se. But if we were under the same standard as businesses are quite frequently, it wouldn't be enough for the cop to say, well, he broke the speed limit. Okay, you're guilty. It's a thou shalt not thing. The prosecutor would also have to show that in so doing, you actually directly and measurably hurt somebody in so doing. We don't live under that kind of law. Wouldn't it be nice if we did? Most of our laws would pretty much be unenforceable because there would not be an ability to demonstrate that second part. Oh, it was general harm to the people, so we don't even have to worry about that. All we have to worry about is that you did it. The two approaches the economists were offering, the one side was saying, if it is a monopoly, if it concentrates an industry unduly, that's it, right there, gone. They're guilty. The other side, the apologists for business economists, as it were, and all those shills, they said, no, just showing that there's a concentrated industry isn't enough. You have to show that there was a material harm done to the market through this concentration. Okay? The Supreme Court actually found against Standard Oil, but they put into constitutional law the performance test, which meant that there were a number of cases that came afterwards where the prosecutors couldn't show the material harm part. They could show that they were monopolies or highly concentrated industries, but they couldn't show that they're the measurable harm. Think about how it works. I'm a business lawyer, and you come to me, you're an expert witness. And, well, it's a monopoly. Well, okay, that's very nice, ma'am. Now, what do monopolies do? Well, they cause lower output and higher price. Okay, so you're saying that if this market had been in competition, the prices would have been lower than they are now. Yes, I am. Okay, how much lower? Well, I don't know. Well, wait, what do you mean you don't know? Your Honor, jury, you don't know? Give me a number. The price is this now. What would the price be in perfect competition? Well, I don't know. We haven't had perfect competition. Oh, whoa, you don't know? So you can't give me a number? Oh, that's right. You're an economist. You're into theory. Shot it to death with that attack. Case after case was wiped out because the economists couldn't show what happens in perfect competition because we'd never seen perfect competition. They'd been monopolies all along, so it's pretty hard to find out what you would be like if you were had been born without original sin, because you've already always had original sin, you sinful son of a bitch. You see, it's one of those things where, well, what does a colon look like when it is clean? We don't know because everyone shits. To put it graphically, real economics for real people. Do you understand how, I mean, essentially this good old boy setup in the Supreme Court put a time bomb in there, and it was impossible in many cases to get around it. You couldn't show the second half of the two-step prosecution. You could show the pro se commission of the crime, but you couldn't do the second part. So, we come into the 20th century, and in the first decade, you saw cases, some were successful, but there was also the problem that you have to understand that there was no enforcement, general enforcement agency for antitrust law. The same prosecutors who were chasing robbers and murderers and rapists and all of that were in charge of chasing down corporate criminals. And that made for a very difficult situation. How many prosecutions can you afford to do, even at the government level? And this was, of course, the era when you had the bad guys coming out of the woodwork from the old days trying to fight more civilized times in the 20th century. It was not very pleasant. So, what we did in... And I mentioned this a couple of times before in the class, is that you had, of course, Theodore Roosevelt, and he called himself a trust-busting president, and he was not a man to be trifled with. He was the bully president and all that. But even he couldn't get around this difficulty with the Supreme Court and this constitutional law that they had created in the wake of the statutory law. So we come into the 19-teens, and a slightly more liberal era, actually a rather dramatically more liberal era, kind of swept over for just a little while. Yeah, Congress was more liberal, and we had, by modern standards, a liberal president, Woodrow Wilson. It was in this time frame that in 1914, in this reform kind of era, that we begin to see an effort to push back on several fronts. The government had always been anti-labor union. You began to see the government sort of stepping back and knocking off its support for business, cracking down on labor unions. And you also saw a great deal of interest in tightening up the Sherman Antitrust Act. And so in 1914, an amendment to the Sherman Act was passed. It was called the Clayton Act. It's an amendment. And then a separate, standalone piece of legislation was passed called the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, let me hit... the Clayton Act first. It was actually an amendment to Sherman. Now, in Clayton, let me start with giving you exactly some of the details of Clayton. Section 2 of the Clayton Act. Whoa! Do you remember where I started when I started the Sherman Antitrust Act? Section 1. Congress was getting smart. You see, I just started with Section 2 with the specifics in Clayton. They knew that they had to start being very specific in definitions, in explanations, and clear directions for courts. No federal courts. You don't get to decide what we meant. We're going to tell you this is a definition, this is a reason, this is a definition, this is a reason. You don't get the latitude you had when you shot down Sherman's blade. We are going to tell you in section one, this, 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 and this. And we see that more in modern legislation. This, before any specifics are done, there's a section that lays everything out, gives guidance to the courts so the courts don't have to be activists. Makes it as clear as we can what we mean in the statute. So section two first outlaws price discrimination where there is no actual cost difference. No price discrimination if there is no cost, actual cost difference. So in other words, I can't do this kind of thing where I'm going to give you a really low price on this because, you know, you stick with me. You keep the competitor stuff way back on the shelves and you put ours at the front. So you're going to get a lower price. You put our competitor stuff right up with ours, really? You're going to pay full wholesale price. Besides, he's going to marry my daughter and she's ugly. Section 3 prohibits exclusivity clauses. Now, there are two flavors of exclusivity clause. There is one called the tie-in sale. And there's another one called bundling. These were both done by Microsoft, which is how it came to be the dominant monopoly market concentrator in software. With tie-in sales, to give you how Microsoft's version of it, in the 1990s, most people were still using, early 1990s, people were still using DOS, a disk operating system where you had a C prompt and you typed in commands. Some of you, if you remember that, then you're either old or you're way too hipster. Then Apple had this great idea for graphical user interfaces, and people who had Apple computers, they knew this was really cool. So, of course, Bill Gates wanted to get in on this. Click and launch programs, copy and paste, no longer had to type it and all that. So he created something called Windows. Now, it was in the same time frame, a little bit earlier. You see, there had always been an internet, not always, but even in my time, when I was a kid, there was an internet. We called it ARPANET at the time. And it wasn't HTTP, in other words, Hypertext Transfer Protocol. It was a FTP, File Transfer Protocol. We would throw files at each other, and the file might have text in it. We had something called Telnet. It was like a very primitive message boarding system and all that. This was all around, way, way back, even into the 70s. And we use it all the time. But there was a lot of talk that this whole connection of computers. Now, the reason we did it was that we believed in that time that there was going to be a very high probability of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. And the idea of having this ARPANET, and the military was part of it, would be that no matter how hard the Soviets hit us and blew away cities, knocked out universities, military installations, this brain would still have all these threads connecting people to people, institutions to institutions. And that was why we had it. And we also, in academia and the military, we communicated through this system by electronic means, using telephones and modems as, you know, catch on. Anyway, you know, you remember that Soviet problem. God. Well, MILSNET broke off from ARPANET because they started suspecting us academics of being radical liberal communists and all that. But at the end of the 1980s, 1990s, there were a couple of very enlightened members of Congress. Among them, interestingly enough, a man named Al Gore, who saw the possibility of creating a public internet that everyone could use, businesses could communicate through it. We could, instead of having text and all that, we could have pretty graphical interfaces. And eventually, although I'm sure they didn't think about it at the time, we could have the most important things of all on the internet: Angry Birds and porn. So Al Gore was a spear point of this, and several others were too, to upgrade the telephone system of the country with $6 billion, I think it was, and to make it so that people could use this system. As a matter of fact, in the year 2000, Gore was running against George W. Bush. Gore made this statement: "I invented the internet," and everyone made fun of him. In a way, he kind of did, although his pompous ass overstated it. But nevertheless, it wasn't long before you started seeing web pages showing up. But the web pages had to have a program that could read hypertext, this text that had little characters around it, bold this word, italicize this word, put a picture here. So you had to have a browser that could read that code and turn it into a visual experience for people. Well, the big browser that came about very quickly was called Netscape. And computer manufacturers started putting Netscape, the Netscape Navigator, on every computer that they made and sold. Bill Gates had a lousy browser called Internet Explorer. And he wanted all these computer manufacturers to put Internet Explorer on the computers they were building. So what did he do? He just started calling the manufacturers, he and his cronies, and said, if you don't get rid of Netscape and put Internet Explorer on, we'll pull your license for this really popular thing called Windows we're letting you use. Well, the computer manufacturers just pissed their pants. They dumped Netscape like a boss and put Internet Explorer on there. That was the end of Netscape. Netscape was the coolest browser you would ever want to imagine. Gone. Tie-in sale. Illegal. When I say Bill Gates is a criminal, I'm not messing around. He even admitted to it. His people even admitted to it in a judgment in 2000. Didn't matter. By that time, Bill Gates owned the universe, and he owned a good substantial part of the townhouse that God leases. So nothing came of it. He could say, yeah, I did it. Screw you. Bundling. Here's another Gates scheme. The very popular word processor from the time I was using computers, and that was, yes, that was about when Jesus walked the earth, was a word processor called WordPerfect. It was originally a text processor, but very early on they turned it into a graphical, graphical user interface. WordPerfect was everything. Everyone used WordPerfect. Law firms, businesses of all kinds, academics, college students, we all used it. Why? Because WordPerfect didn't have any copy protection on the disks that it sold. They knew very well that if I get hooked on WordPerfect as a college student and hack a copy of it, I'll buy it legit when I get older, and I sure did. Well, you see, everyone had WordPerfect, bought WordPerfect, so what did Bill Gates do? He started putting his company's word processor on as a freebie, and when you opened up Windows on your brand new computer, there was Word, a little icon. Well, there's a word processor here. I guess I don't have to buy me no WordPerfect. Destroyed WordPerfect. Bundling. Yes, another criminal act that destroyed companies, restrained trade, altered the course of industries, and it was done in violation of Clayton. Last. And also, Section 7 of the Clayton Act prohibited market concentration. It just said you can't concentrate markets too much. You go beyond a certain degree of concentration, we'll kick your ass. 50%, 60%, whatever. Paralleling the Sherman Amendment called Clayton was the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, it tied up a few loose ends with Clayton that Clayton had left out. Like, for example, predatory pricing. Predatory pricing is when a company sells below marginal cost of production with the purpose of restraining trade. That was what John D. Rockefeller was doing. And they finally got around, oh, it's illegal, predatory pricing. Now, there's a variation on predatory pricing that is legal because it isn't for the purpose of restraining trade. Did any of you ever hear of something called a loss leader? Okay, they're still around, but they were much more popular back in the day. We used to get these newspapers with a flyer for the grocery stores. 25 cents for a loaf of bread. Hamburger, 39 cents a pound. These are actually, the prices are below marginal cost of production. That's predatory pricing, except that it wasn't for the purpose of hurting your competition. It was just so that people would come into your store and pay for the higher priced stuff. Eggs, 20 cents a dozen. Yeah, I go in there and buy the eggs for 20 cents a dozen, and then I look around, hey, that's some good shit there. And you buy that, that's overpriced. Loss leaders are okay. I remember my mother, God bless, rest her soul. She would get all of the flyers from the grocery stores, identify the loss leaders. We would go from store to store just buying loss leaders. She dragged me along, do not look at anything else, fat boy, we are buying the eggs. And we leave with just the eggs. Most people didn't do it that way. But, Federal Trade Commission Act also, its most important thing was it created the Federal Trade Commission that oversees antitrust law. The Federal Trade Commission prosecutes civilly, and if there's enough bad going on, they get the evidence together for the Department of Justice to prosecute criminally. The Federal Trade Commission and the courts are very happy with this, and they don't listen to companies that cry to them about regulation, because the courts, these commissions like this, take the burden off the courts and they put it onto the experts in these commissions who know more about what the details and the dynamics of the law and what the law is applying to. Now I'm coming to the last piece of this, though. And this has to do, understand that there's one more act in 1936 that I will highlight. It's called Robinson-Patman, and I'm going to talk about that quite a bit here in a minute. Robinson-Patman Act of 1936. After the Robinson-Patman Act, there was no significant antitrust legislation until a toothless piece of legislation in 1976 called Scott-Hart-Rodino was passed. The Scott-Hart-Rodino Antitrust Improvement Act was passed in 1976. Now, this isn't in the PowerPoint. You'll need to write this one down. It basically, what it did was, it said the Federal Trade Commission has the authority to either qualify or disqualify mergers. But it really hasn't had hardly any effect. It hasn't stopped the concentration. As a matter of fact, antitrust law became so antiquated, even by the 1970s, that when the government broke up the Ma Bell Trust, it was a disaster. It was just a disaster, and look where we are now. The whole trust is coming back together again as an oligopoly. But in this time frame, and I promise this is the only place you're ever going to see artwork in an economics class. Even early in the 20th century, in the late 1800s, there was an understanding that modernity, a new world was coming, that the farm life, we couldn't even hold the myth anymore. The idea of the noble person, the individualist, was being taken away by something that was larger and absorbing us all. Now, this was showing up among writer in the intelligentsia was writing about it. Artists, writers, academics, we saw something disturbing. Even the music was beginning to reflect this hustle, this pace. The first photograph, the first painting I'm going to show you is called Machine Gun. It's by a painter named Nevinson. Now, you might imagine that this looks almost amateurish. In fact, it is quite pointed. Nevinson was a soldier in World War II, as well as a painter. Look at the chiseling of those men's helmets. The color matches the color of the machine gun. Everything about these men, their noses, their cheeks, their mouths, their chins, even their beards, is beginning to look like the machines that they were using. I am become war. I am become a machine. A cautionary warning to us that we are coming to an era when our industries and the things, the tools that we use are becoming us. More importantly, we are becoming them and losing our humanity. His warning was just one of many. Nevinson was killed in World War I. I take you to a painting next by one of my favorite painters, Hopper. It's called Nighthawks. This was these cookie-cutter shops that were coming up all over the country. Perfectly cleaned, perfectly sterile, gleaming stainless steel, polished wood, one after the other after the other. They were coming up all over the country. And they would cast a pool of light, and just beyond the pool of light, you really don't want to be out there because it's dark and it's abandoned. But in here, you've got a nice, really clean-cut young man. He's not even talking to anybody. He's talking out there. The man and the woman, they don't even look at each other. They probably loved each other once, but they don't anymore. They're just sitting in there, biding their time until they die. This man is already disappearing into the shadows. He's the cellophane man, half gone, unnoticed. Hopper was warning us. And in this last one, Hopper painted Automat. These I have been in. I remember them. They were knocking out the mom-and-pop stores all over the country. Mom-and-pop operations. You could go in there, put money into a machine, and you got your coffee. It was even in a nice cup. Look at this pretty girl. She is dressed to the nines. Dapper. Just the style you would want. Delicious. And she doesn't have to have anyone bother her. She can sit with her back to the blackness that is the alienation. She can stay there as long as she wants. But of course, eventually, she's going to turn around. Those lights are going to go out only so far before she has to face that blackness that is caused by a world where corporations create cookie cutter one after the other, and they destroy the essence of the small business, the small person, us. These companies offer I. It's not us, it's not we, it's not everyone together. It is I, and I can sit here as long as I want, looking as pretty as I want, and no one's going to touch my makeup and my pretty clothes. The Robinson-Patman Act was called the Chain Store Act. It was designed to prohibit the growth of the chain stores and the volume discounters and those massive mega stores that were beginning to wipe out the mom and pop operations in the 1930s. Of course, we know how successful that is. I'll see you all at Walmart. Thank you.